Welcome to 35 West, a podcast about politics and policy in the 35 countries of the Western Hemisphere. Today I have as my guest Roger Noriega, Ambassador Roger Noriega, who served as the Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs at the U.S. State Department and also earlier as the Ambassador to the Organization of American States. So, Roger, I heard about you before I met you. And the reason I heard about you is this is back in 2000, I think, and you had just been named, I think, Ambassador to the OAS. And I would say more than three quarters of the Bureau of Western Hemisphere Affairs was terrified because you were known as the Jesse Helms fire breather. Then you got to the State Department. Everyone goes, hey, he's actually a pretty nice guy. So welcome. So tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, how did you end up to where you are? You're now at the AEI, but you've had a distinguished career in foreign policy on the Hill at the State Department. Tell us a little bit sort of where the Roger Noriega story.
Well, started really in Washington on Capitol Hill. Always was interested in politics. From the congressional office there, made my first trip to Central America, eventually joined the Reagan administration, did that until in political positions until President Clinton came in. Then I did my 8 years in exile on Capitol Hill, having the two most important jobs on Latin America, and then came back in under Bush 43 in a couple of really interesting positions. And I was honored to serve. I've been out of government for 10 years now, stay involved through my work as a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, focusing on Latin America, stay abreast of all the issues, and have been asked on a regular basis to testify before Congress about what's going on in the region and why it should matter to the United States.
And you are originally from Kansas, correct?
Right. I'm from Wichita, Kansas. Get back there often. If Kansas had a foreign policy, I would be living in Kansas. I like it very much. It's what I refer to as the real world. But at this point, Washington, which is a very livable place, is confronting important issues. And this is a place where I want to try to make a contribution on a part of the world that I care about very much. But most importantly, how do we make the United States safer and more prosperous?
And if my memory serves me correctly, is it your father that was from Mexico or your mother?
Both of my parents are from Kansas, mm-hmm. but all four of my grandparents emigrated to the United States in the 20s to Kansas from Mexico. And they, not one of them was a bad hombre. They were good people and hardworking people, as most immigrants are. And at any rate, that I learned Spanish actually in the State Department. When my parents were trying to teach me Spanish.
So not just a professional, but a personal connection, affiliation to the region.
Absolutely.
So let me ask you a little bit about, you recently were up on the Hill testifying to the Senate on Colombia. And in particular, you were talking about the peace process. And let me quote, you said, at a time when the peace process needed an umpire, the U.S. became a cheerleader. And you went on to term the peace process, or maybe our policy, a foreign policy failure. So is the Colombia peace process doomed? And if it is, why do you think so?
Well, you know, everybody wants peace, right? And at that time, when one of my best friends in Colombia, Humberto de la Calle, was beginning as the chief negotiator, I felt that the United States had to find a way to support that process. Otherwise, you know, what are you going to do, eradicate 7,500 people or combatants and all of their followers? Certainly that wasn't a realistic option. I think that I believed that the strategy that President Uribe used to use coercion to pressure the guerrillas to come to the bargaining table and to negotiate, and he dealt with a number of different criminal guerrilla organizations and had success in demobilizing tens of thousands of people. I felt that that strategy of coercion was really important. President Santos, I think, felt that the guerrillas were essentially strategically defeated, but I think he failed to understand that their objectives had transmogrified, Armed struggle was not the only way of reaching their objective of winning power and influence in over Colombia's future. So I was a little bit concerned that the United States was too passive an observer in this process. I think we should have been reasoning with Santos and his negotiators about what are the real objectives of the FARC, and how, frankly, do you frustrate the objectives of a group that has not denounced its Marxist-Leninist objectives? What is their priority, and how do you get your arms around the vast resources that the FARC now has access to as it moves into a political struggle? And I think that some of these issues were not addressed effectively. The United States lost traction in a big way over coca cultivation, where you now see a doubling in the last 5 years of coca, potential cocaine production, because of crops not being fumigated, because of the government essentially standing down the military in terms of confronting these guerrillas that were also in the cocaine business. And so I think we lost traction. And that's something we have to deal with, work with Colombia in a clear-headed way to try to get our arms around that issue now, or you're going to see lawlessness continue and maybe even things get worse in terms of the FARC having greater capacity to change the course of events in Colombia.
Let me follow up with a question about the FARC or the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. It seems like such a throwback to kind of, you know, the 70s, this Marxist guerrilla group. And where other countries have sort of seen that die off or moved on, it persists in Colombia. What is their base of support now, sort of politically, financially? Why are they still around as a force?
Well, I mean, this is a throwback to the 60s in point of fact. And it began. Its origins were definitely rooted in an inequality, abuse by the elite political class in the country of the campesinos, the peasants in the rural areas. A political class that was sort of estranged from the rest of the country. Things have changed appreciably. We're talking about, by the way, South America's oldest democracy, and these institutions function more or less well in terms of channeling the ambitions and interests of the Colombian people. But corruption has continued to degrade the capacity of democracy to really deliver for the Colombian people. I don't think you've seen Colombia maximizing its economic potential. But a lot of that has had to do with the war as well. And so Santos's proposition is, let's end the war so that our democratic institutions can function more effectively, so our economy can grow, so we can create more opportunity from people across the board and address some of those root causes of the conflict.
You alluded earlier to the increase in coca production, and of course that is related to the decrease in aerial eradication, manual eradication by the Colombians. And as you know, these are pretty sophisticated, labor-intensive, expensive programs. Does the government of Colombia have both the will and the resources to restart, if they decide to, both aerial spraying, manual eradication without significant help from the United States?
Well, let's understand, as I was alluding, what's the true nature of the FARC. It sort of morphed into a drug trafficking organization as a means for generating revenue for their struggle. And there was, earlier on an alliance with the narco-traffickers and the FARC as a guerrilla group. But it gradually became more and more involved, the FARC, directly in the production of cocaine. And this generates vast sums of money, probably in this last 15 years, $10 billion or more in revenue. And so I think it was just a little too convenient that in the context of these discussions, these peace talks, the FARC said, you got to stop coming after our drug smuggling routes. By the way, you know, we think glyphosate is poisoning peasants. This glyphosate is an herbicide that's basically Roundup that's sprayed by U.S. contract aircraft as part of our program to cut back on the cultivation of cocaine and coca and cocaine production. That went away because the UN sort of pointed to some pseudoscience and said that this somebody may die by from Roundup. We also gave up on extradition of FARC kingpins, and now you see anecdotal information of narco traffickers paying $5 million to get their FARC ID cards because that makes them eligible for amnesty. You see this sort of thing. So we lost traction gradually. And the U.S., I think, which was eager to support the peace process, should have been a little more rigorous in insisting on, you can't give away so much that the FARC has the capacity to continue its criminal activities as it's supposed to be renouncing violence and certainly renouncing criminality and joining a political process. Now you have the FARC, important elements of the FARC, staying engaged in narco trafficking. They call themselves dissidents, so they've actually appropriated a political word to talk about these criminal activities. They will stay engaged. The FARC may have continued access to this revenue. This is something we should have focused on before. What was the end game? How do you, what was the real danger posed by the FARC, and how do you address that as you try to make peace and as you try to demobilize and put an end to the war without giving away too much in terms of criminality and now ending up with a group that's supposed to be involved in politics having vast resources at its disposal.
So when we talk about sort of policy shortcomings or the administration not doing this or that, we're really talking about the last 8 years of the Obama administration. Obviously, we have a new administration in town. Now, the budget request actually proposes a decrease in aid to Colombia. What is that? What's going on there?
Well, I think as a practical matter, you're going to see the Trump administration asks for like a 30% decrease in funding to Colombia. The House and Senate are probably going to end up at right about current levels of funding. That's what the appropriators have approved, at least on the committee level. So I think you're going to see continued engagement. The policymakers, at least in Congress, are saying, look, we're going to support law enforcement efforts. We're going to continue to support getting after cultivation of a cocaine. We're going to continue to press on extradition and other issues of that nature. It remains to be seen how our State Department will line up. Certainly in the last 8 years, they have said, we're not going to press on extradition. And you have some people, great professionals who didn't have the kind of leverage that they needed over the Santos government. That's going to change because you're going to have a new president in Colombia as well. And I think it's important that our policymakers be able to press the Colombians on, a rigorous manual eradication, a consideration of a resuming aerial fumigation so you can get to these industrial-sized plantations of coca because you don't want to lose any more control over cocaine production levels because that means more and more criminality impacting not only Colombia but its neighbors and the well-being of American people who are the consumers of these illegal drugs.
So we're gonna move countries now. And of course, you were U.S. ambassador to the OAS. And a couple weeks ago, I had Ben Gadan of the Wilson Center, and sitting right where you're sitting right now. And he had just written a piece in the Wall Street Journal basically saying, we need to do away with the OAS, or we need to reshape it or reform it, because they basically have not been able to deal with Venezuela and specifically put the finger on the Caribbean countries. So I wanted to get your reaction to that. And then sort of more broadly, where do you see, you know, Venezuela heading, and what can the U.S. do about it?
Well, I'll talk a little bit about Venezuela, because they just had elections in Venezuela at the gubernatorial level. And most observers, certainly opposition, says that the government, essentially a narco-dictatorship, has stolen most of the governor's seats, and certainly all but one of the important governor's seats. And so they're crying foul, and they're going to be appealing to the international community for more sanctions. And that's where we come to the OAS, where this is an organization that operates usually by consensus. And of its 34 member states, about 14 of them are Caribbean. And Ben Gadan's proposition is that because these countries are under disproportionate influence of the petrodiplomacy of first Chavez and now Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, that their loyalties are to their pocketbook as a country, keeping the lights on with cheap oil, rather than to their principles, defending democracy in the hemisphere. You know, first off, it's not a monolith. The Caribbean countries, some of them have come around on this issue. And frankly, 90% of the population of the Western Hemisphere has lined up in support of stronger measures. I think we haven't been wise enough and proactive enough in our diplomacy in convincing the Caribbean countries of what's at stake there. Communicating with their people about the long-term impact of the disintegration of Venezuela at the hands of a corrupt criminal regime. I think we should have been more effective. And so frankly, I think, and Ben was working at the NSC and in the State Department in an administration that I don't think did enough. He wanted to do more, I'm sure. But in point of fact, his bosses did not do enough to engage on this in the Venezuela question. I think you have a different team, a very clearly different team. I have not been a cheerleader for the Trump administration generally, for the president in particular, but I will say I think they've gotten this right. I think H.R. McMaster, the vice president, working with bipartisan folks on the Hill, understand what's at stake in Venezuela, that it's a broader threat, that the narco dictatorship there poses to the United States, and that we have to, you know, use all of the levers, in this case targeted sanctions against regime leaders, to get their attention. And now you've seen the Colombians, the Mexicans, the Canadians joining that process, and we need to get the Europeans to join as well. And it may be after this debacle in the stolen elections, they'll see what's at stake, and they'll be more eager to join us. But so will our friends in the OAS, in my opinion. I think the OAS is a unique organization in the Western Hemisphere. It's the oldest regional organization of its kind. And frankly, the United States doesn't get its way all of the time. But as a neighbor, who does, right? And I think that operating by consensus, we are able to fashion solutions that generally work well for all of us, for the community in general. And the right kind of rigorous diplomacy, particularly on an issue as important as Venezuela, we should get our way more often than not, because we should appeal to the principles and values of the people in these countries.
On Venezuela, what do you see as sort of the end game? I mean, a year ago, if you know, someone had said, well, we're going to have 2,000% inflation. We're going to have shortages of foodstuffs and toilet paper. People losing incredible amounts of weight because they're starving. I think almost everyone would predict, well, that government's not going to last. But yet here it is. So is there a hypothetical breaking point in your mind after which the Maduro government certainly can't succeed? I mean, is it Russian money or Chinese money that once that goes, they're out? Or Are we in a sort of weird situation where they can just have sort of steady state repression indefinitely?
I don't think that will happen because, first off, as I just described, you have more of the international community, even more importantly in Latin America and the Caribbean, recognizing the reality there. And I don't think that it's possible for the Venezuelans to get enough outside support from Russia and China to keep the ball in the air here. I think they're very close to a default on some of their payments. They're running out of cash. You just can't. Repression is not right. going to be sufficient.
They've already missed some payments, haven't they? Aren't they late on some key payments?
They are. I think they're particularly, even in the Inter-American Development Bank, one of my sources told me that they have not been able to make a payment even after a 30-day grace period. And so that's something that when they start to default on in the bond markets and it becomes more public, the economy becomes more and more vulnerable to people posing liens against their property in different parts of the world. And when you're an oil economy, you know, most of what you've got is overseas, right, in certain ways. And so they're exposed. I just think that these elections, where they stole those elections so blatantly, may end up being a Pyrrhic victory for Maduro. Because it's going to consolidate opposition not only in the country with this kind of inept opposition, but just as importantly among neighbors that see that it's going to be time for change soon. That Maduro, we can't preside over the consolidation of a narco-dictatorship and a humanitarian crisis here in the Western Hemisphere.
Well, I hope I don't have you on in 6 months and we're still talking about the Maduro regime. Hopefully, we'll be talking about the day after the successor regime. But Roger, I want to thank you very much for joining me today. And join us next week for another edition of 35 West.